technology can also help us when we're unable to see a process and its performance. Data capture and communicative technologies help in these situations. GPS, for instance, is a wonderful technology for illuminating an otherwise hard-to-see process from afar. When we marry GPS with expected checkpoints, we can be notified if a shipment is late, for instance. Shipping companies like UPS and FedEx use this technology effectively to let us know where a package is in transit, offering insight as to when we can expect delivery. Finally, any physical equipment that we might use to lighten the load or speed up the work represents technology too. We need to embrace equipment technology when it advances our processes and especially when it prevents us from sending people into hazardous situations where they're at risk of injury. The challenge of operations management is to use operational strategy to guide the processes, people, and technology that constitute operational capability in order to achieve business success. It isn't a quick or easy task. Further, once you think you've got it figured out, it's probably time to start all over again and revisit these decisions. The decisions are anything but static. As opportunities and threats present themselves, the operations of the company must adapt. In the fortunate situation of growth, maintaining quality when the business expands can be a real predicament. Let's look at a case study that sheds light on how to use operations management to bring a company vision into reality. Note that this example features operations in two ways. One, in the production of the product, and two, in the provision of service, bringing both production operations and service operations into scope. In Columbus, Ohio, Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream is a treasured institution. In a product category market that is seemingly oversaturated with options, Jenny's stands out for its unique flavors, product quality, and first-rate service. Like most businesses, though, Jenny's started from humble beginnings. Founder Jenny Britton Bauer had the idea of producing artisanal ice creams using the freshest ingredients from nearby dairy, fruit, and vegetable farms, with the pledge to make the best ice creams we could imagine. She opened her first shop in downtown Columbus in 2002. The ice creams are produced in small batches from the freshest ingredients. The milk, for instance, is all sourced from grass-grazed cows on dairy farms located within 200 miles of Columbus. The flavor ingredients are all natural and free from stabilizers, with most fruits and vegetables sourced from nearby farms. The product has received countless accolades, and a New York Times review once indicated that Jenny's had, and I quote here, surpassed the creativity of all other ice cream makers with its versions like goat cheese and cognac fig sauce. But my personal favorite is salty caramel. It's really good, trust me. In the shop, you'll find friendly faces who know all about the ice creams and yogurt products on the menu. These ice cream ambassadors, as they're called, are asked, according to a recent job posting, to provide consistent, world-class service to every single customer, exhibit passion for the community, an eye for detail, a willingness to clean a lot, stamina to serve people in long lines, and the ability to work in an exciting, fast-paced environment. In total, what we have here is an example of a differentiated product and service experience for which Jenny's is able to charge a premium price. Jenny's is not the destination if you're looking for just any old ice cream. Jenny's is where you'll find Jenny's ice cream and knowledgeable service around the product, and those differences justify the premium. But success brings its own challenges. When demand exceeded the capacity of the single shop downtown in Columbus, Jenny's opened up new locations around town to the current count of 10 shops. And the question became one of scale. Could Jenny's continue to provide the same high quality in the product and service experience at multiple locations throughout the city? So far, the small company, and more importantly, the market, have answered with a resounding yes. But to do so, Jenny's had to find a way to scale up its operations formula, much like a cook who usually makes meals for 4 suddenly has to prepare a banquet for 100. Then came the next challenge. Grocery retailers. They started clamoring to stock Jenny's product throughout the region. This required a new set of operations to package the ice cream for grocery sales. We also now see vending machines around the city also stocking the ice creams. And you can guess the next chapter, opening shops outside the region, which the company has done with new shops in Cleveland, Atlanta, Nashville, Charleston, South Carolina, Chicago, and New York City. Only time will tell whether Jenny's will be able to achieve the same success in these other locations, replicating its business model. Taking a so-called winning formula on the road has worked for some companies in the past, but not for others. It could be that Jenny's will still need to make more changes to the operations part of its formula to accommodate the growth. But adaptation is what good operations management is all about. All organizations, from startups to huge multinational corporations, must adapt to stay relevant to customers. And adapting the company's operations is a critical part of that process. Adaptation is the only timeless secret of success. And Charles Darwin let the secret out. The only difference between life in the natural world that he examined and life in the business world is that innovative companies can actually force the evolution. They can create needs that customers themselves didn't realize they had. And this brings us back to Apple. Before it was invented, did it ever occur to you that you needed an app that simulates bubble wrap that you can pop on your iPhone or iPad at your leisure? It relieves stress almost as well as the real bubble wrap. Apple has created not only the hardware to make these things possible, but also the App Store, which makes available more than 1.2 million different apps and counting that allow you to use your mobile device in almost any way you wish. Apple doesn't even create most of the apps that the App Store sells. It simply makes it possible for others to invent and sell them and takes a cut of the proceeds, which amounted to more than $10 billion in 2013. That's another smart move. A great operations company is one that takes advantage of change. It doesn't view new preferences, tastes, or ideas as problems, but as opportunities to seize. Operations is the capability behind innovation. It delivers on the promise, and that's what makes it one of the most exciting, vital, and dynamic aspects of business in the 21st century.
This lecture is titled Leaner, Meaner Production.
Do you remember buying shoes when you were a kid? Not those dull dress shoes, but shoes for school or play? Nike was just making its way to the national market when I was a kid. And it was a big deal to pick among the shoes with either the red, blue, or black swoosh. Oh, the choices. It's a different story today, right? Shoes come in every color you can imagine. But now you can select the mix of colors for a wholly customized shoe. Through the Nike ID website, you can take a base model and customize it to your heart's content. Or download the Nike ID app, take a photo of something that you want the shoes to match, and let the app design the shoe for you. How cool is that? Nike offers a prime example of how production operations are changing the way we live today. Thanks in part to new technologies, production operations are leveraging the preferences of consumers to provide us with not only variety, but customization, and delivering our customized products in a short amount of time at a reasonable cost. Operations, you'll recall, is the business activity that fulfills the promises that companies make to their customers. It includes the sourcing of materials and goods, the conversion of those inputs into something that someone else wants to buy, and the delivery of those goods. Production operations are operations that involve the provision of actual goods, sneakers, cars, smartphones, and the like, as opposed to the provision of services. Production operations for tangible physical goods are also referred to as manufacturing operations and have the primary function of converting inputs into desired outputs for customers. They represent the greatest value-adding activity in all of business. They transform the useless into the useful, something that someone is willing to pay for. So let's look at how production operations work. Now, why might you find yourself needing to make a product in the first place? Few businesses set out wanting to make something, anything. No, instead they recognize some unmet need out there, a market opportunity for a product that no one else provides, or a way to build an existing product better or cheaper. The making of the product is simply a response to the need, the opportunity to create value and sell it. New products may come in one of two kinds: product extensions or new-to-the-world products. The most common new product is the extension variety, which is usually an adaptation of an already successful product, a way of making that product better in some way. And we see these in the grocery business all the time, like Coca-Cola adding lime flavor to the Diet Coke, or Frito-Lay introducing a new flavor of Doritos chip. These products don't tend to require the same level of research and development or prototyping when compared to really new products that have a longer path from the picture in the inventor's mind to tangible form. New-to-the-world products require added demonstration and testing. Once the product concept proves functionally viable, it must prove its viability from a market and economic standpoint. The question becomes, I wonder if I could sell this. With the firm belief that enough people just might want to buy your product and that no one else is serving that need, you can turn your attention to how to make it. Can you make it at such a cost that you could sell it for something more to earn a profit? With affirmative responses to these questions and some financial backing, congratulations, you're a budding entrepreneur. To be a successful entrepreneur, though, you need to make your vision a reality and become an actual provider of a new product. That's where production operations comes in. Notice that I didn't say you need to become the manufacturer of a new product, but the provider. A fundamental decision that any company interested in selling products must make is whether to produce the product in-house or to hire an outside company to manufacture the product on its behalf. This determination of insourcing or outsourcing is often called the make versus buy decision. Both options are considered part of production operations, but they involve very different organizational arrangements, and the choice between the two can be pretty complicated. So let me break it down for you. We'll start off with some simple economics. What would it cost you to produce the product? Here, you'll need to take into account the property, plant, equipment, and associated taxes and depreciation. Once fixed capital expense investments are tabulated, you need to turn your attention to the cost of running the operations, including the buying of materials, securing labor, and paying utilities. A simple cost per unit can be calculated by dividing the sum of the annual cost by the volume you expect to produce. This simple average can then give you a basis to shop against the prices that outside companies would charge you for their services. With a web search and some homework, you can locate a contract manufacturer, or many, willing to produce your product for a price. The trick is to compare the anticipated quality and price that the outside vendor offers with the quality you would achieve and the cost you would incur in-house. Complicating the analysis is the expectation of future sales. If the product's a big hit, you could cover your fixed cost investments with increasing sales volume, but it might also require you to expand the operations in a hurry. Also, life as a do-it-yourself manufacturer can get complicated quickly when customers start asking for different items or unique packaging. Remember our Nike idea example? Just as we consumers seek unique, differentiated products, so too do business customers. Big retailers and distributors want to be able to say that they offer product varieties and assortments that can't be found anywhere else. That might be fine, but what if you sell to and through many different retailers, all demanding unique products? Okay, now you've got a problem. But contract manufacturers excel at making adaptations because manufacturing is their core competency. It's what they do. They tend to have skills in developing proper tooling and quick changeovers from one product to another, since they typically serve a multitude of customers. They also can offer economic advantages as the production facility is shared with multiple clients. The costs get spread across all of these clients. Sounds good, eh? That's why many young companies that are bringing products to market for the first time choose to buy over make. They can get into business without having to build a whole factory and invest in manufacturing equipment and a trained workforce first. But there are also disadvantages to going to the outside. And the biggest one is control. You find yourself at the mercy of an outside party to do the job for you. The risk is that the contract manufacturer won't have your best interest at heart when producing your goods. There's even the risk that the company learns how to make your product and they could steal it, maybe by making a small alteration to it, or in countries with poor oversight of intellectual property rights, stealing your product design outright. For that reason, you need to analyze the transaction cost associated with hiring an outside party. Transaction cost analysis, or TCA, is a distinct branch of economics that examines the cost of monitoring another party to act on your behalf. Professor Oliver Williamson of UC Berkeley received the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2009 for advancing the theory of transaction cost economics. Transaction costs include the cost of being taken advantage of and monitoring the outside party to ensure that they act in accordance with your expectations. This may seem like a long ways from production operations, but it's all part of getting a product to market successfully. Now, the make versus buy decision is not unique to new or small firms. It's something that even the giant purveyors of brands entertain. This is certainly the case with most fashion apparel companies. They hand over their design sketches and sometimes the materials to a contract manufacturer that fulfills every step, from fabrication through distribution to retailers. Many other industries do the same thing. It's estimated that the global market for contract manufacturing in medical devices is approximately $50 billion. And the electronics market is over $450 billion, with both expecting robust growth for the foreseeable future. Many companies looking to outsource opt for suppliers in low-cost countries, where wages for labor are far lower than in developed countries. This practice of offshoring has gained widespread adoption in many industries. It's been said that the three scariest words in U.S. business in the early 2000s were the China price, the term that powerful customers like Walmart used to demand rock-bottom prices from their suppliers. It often occurred that when one company elected to offshore operations to a low-cost country, all competing companies suddenly found themselves at a cost disadvantage and had to follow suit. Some who have elected to outsource end up retracting that decision when they find out that they've underestimated the transaction cost involved, and the amount of oversight required to ensure supply of good quality products proves too taxing. This is particularly true when manufacturing problems make product recalls necessary. Recalls can be a nightmare for companies. They're very costly to manage and can cause irreparable damage to a brand image. Another circumstance that would warrant reconsideration of outsourcing is the discovery of labor abuses at contract manufacturing locations. Such were the concerns with electronics manufacturing in China and apparel manufacturing in Bangladesh. Public pressures and increasingly government regulations are forcing companies to be more transparent about who they hire, where the supplier is located, and the standards in place to ensure that work practices are consistent with Western norms. Nike, which was once the focus of great criticism, now discloses the street address and worker profile of the more than 700 factories that produce its branded products around the world. And anyone can access this information right there on the company's website. And some companies go even further. They go so far as to reward whistleblowers at contract manufacturers who report valid labor safety concerns. In cases of quality defects, recalls, and labor abuses, companies are learning that they cannot simply blame the independent manufacturer that may be located several thousand miles away. Or if it's your brand on the product, you will be held fully accountable in most courts and also in the court of public opinion. And public opinion can be far more damning. Just ask Kathy Lee Gifford. Way back in 1996, a clothing line sold at Walmart bearing her name was tied to sweatshop labor conditions in Honduras. She went on to become a champion for human rights and child protection legislation, but the association of her name with immoral labor practices lingered for many years. If, despite these cautions, you still elect to hire an outside manufacturer to produce your product, work with an attorney seasoned in negotiating such deals, who knows the ins and outs of doing business in the sourcing and distribution markets. Don't just rely on an independent broker to set up the deal. This is especially important when doing business across national boundaries. Put simply, it's no place for an amateur to tread. There's too much at risk. Let's say you decide that you're better off making your product yourself. What are the key production operations decisions and best practices that you need to be aware of? The first big decision is to determine the manufacturing strategy to employ. And there are five primary strategies to consider. And what sets them apart is the timing of the work that's done. The first strategy is what's called ship to stock. This is what we call a full anticipatory strategy. Under ship to stock, we put complete faith in our sales forecast, using those numbers to drive the buying of materials, the production of goods, and the distribution of those goods. In other words, we build and distribute the products in advance of demand, and we hope that we guess right, building enough of the product and positioning it in the market. That's a pretty tough thing to pull off, and inevitably we'll either come up short or long on the numbers. Now, why would we subject ourselves to such torment? Because our customers expect to find the product on the shelf, buy it, and make use of it immediately. So this is the scenario that virtually everything sold in conventional stores uses. Like a grocery item, we expect the grocery item to be on the shelf, so companies have to work in advance of us going to the store to acquire the item. Consumers walk into a store expecting to find shelves stocked with the stuff they want to buy. They don't walk in and examine samples and place an order for later delivery. Of course, when you underestimate demand, you're left with disappointed customers. When you overestimate demand, you're left with extra inventory that you need to mark down or even write off. These are the perils of a full anticipatory strategy. One step away from ship to stock is the make to stock strategy. This strategy also puts a lot of faith in the sales forecast to drive actions. In this case, you buy materials in advance and produce the product in accordance with the forecast, but you do not allocate the goods to your distribution locations until you receive the customer order and know exactly where to ship it. This delaying of the delivery step allows you to hold inventory centrally for all distribution locations. Holding inventory in one location allows you to get by with less inventory as you pool or gather the uncertainty of the market at one location. But holding inventory centrally and postponing delivery until you have the order in hand does mean that the customer will have to wait for the delivery. As we progress along the continuum of manufacturing strategies, this is what you can expect to see. With each new strategy, you'll notice that we hold less inventory, which saves money, but we require customers to wait longer to receive the goods they want, which can put us at risk of losing sales. The next strategy in the lineup goes by different names. It's sometimes called assemble to order, configure to order, or mass customization. With this strategy, materials are procured in advance of demand, and products are made only to a semi-finished state. The finished product only takes shape when you learn exactly what the customer wants. So this strategy is ideal when you have the same basic product that can be sold with small differences or mass customized. The customization, then, occurs only after you have the order in hand. This allows a pool of common inventory to cover the needs of customers looking for something slightly different. Again, reducing the inventory required, but requiring additional time to perform the final touches on the goods and to deliver them. Toyota provides a great example of mass customization with their Scion brand of cars. At Scion.com, prospective buyers can select from an array of options to equip their FRS or XB model car. These are two of the five basic models Scion produces. Even though the cars are manufactured to a generic state in Japan, Scion usually promises customers delivery in less than 2 weeks. How can they do this when it can take up to 4 weeks for the cars to travel across the Pacific to U.S. shores? Major U.S. distributors hold large supplies of the cars in their generic state. One distributor is on the East Coast and the other on the West Coast. When a customer hits confirm on a custom build order, the distributor closest to the customer gets to work on that base model, adding the sport shocks and struts, changing out the interior, or altering the base model in any way the customer requests. Through this postponed assemble-to-order strategy, Toyota is able to provide customers with seemingly limitless assortment, yet with much less inventory than if they pre-built the cars to cater to demand. And the truth is, there's no way that a car maker could accurately anticipate the precise specifications of customers anyway. However, customers do have to wait anywhere from a few days to a few weeks to take possession of their new wheels under this system. We'll see if this kind of manufacturing arrangement spreads to more product categories, but it appears very promising. The fourth manufacturing strategy on our continuum is the make-to-order strategy. In this scenario, the manufacturer has the raw materials on hand, but does not commit to assembling them until receiving the customer order. In delaying the assembly process altogether, the manufacturer has even more flexibility to accommodate diverse customer preferences as to the product form and function. This might be the case of a highly customized luxury vehicle. So if you want to take possession of a new Ferrari 458 Italia, be prepared to wait up to 2 years. Savor the anticipation of that delivery day. An example that I use in class that's a little more approachable from a student's perspective doesn't happen in a factory at all. It happens at the Chipotle Mexican Grill, the fast casual restaurant chain that boasts nearly 2,000 locations. When you arrive at a Chipotle, you enter what amounts to a product assembly line with an array of ingredients that can fill your made-to-order burrito. You choose the ingredients you want, and the staff customizes your food item right there in the line. Make-to-order production allows for even greater variation to be accommodated with less inventory on hand. And yes, this is the strategy employed by Nike with the Nike ID example I shared at the outset of the lecture. The fifth and final manufacturing strategy we'll cover is the least speculative of all for the producer. It's the buy-to-order strategy. Under buy-to-order, the producer awaits the customer order before even committing to the raw materials. This allows for products to be truly custom from the ground up, since the producer isn't committed to anything at first. But expect a longer wait if you're the customer of such a system, since everything is delayed until a firm order lands in the hands of the producer. Where do we see such arrangements? These are a little less common than the other strategies, but you might see buy-to-order production in the provision of really big industrial purchases, like aircraft, satellites, and missile defense systems. Manufacturers of these multi-million dollar machines don't usually sell these items out of a warehouse. They collaborate with customers to develop designs and then commit to building them. This process can sometimes take several years. You might also see buy-to-order in the manufacturing of houses, buildings, or commissioned works of art. Here again, lengthy discussions are usually conducted between a producer and buyer in order to understand exactly what the customer wants in the form and function of the product. But it should ensure that only the required materials are purchased, and it can be the least wasteful of inventory. You just need a customer who's willing to wait. Those are the five basic manufacturing strategies that a producer of goods can employ. Large manufacturers often employ multiple strategies to accommodate their different customers with the variety of products that the customer seek. Smaller companies start off with a single strategy, and they're advised to go with the less risky and less speculative strategies like buy-to-order or make-to-order, so that they can conserve cash for investments other than inventory. Eventually, though, customers' tolerance for waiting can give way, and rising competition can influence producers to move toward the other end of the spectrum, being more speculative and taking on inventory of different kinds. Lean thinking has had significant influence on the management of inventory as it relates to production strategies. Traditionally, companies relied on inventory to deal with problems that you might encounter in the course of serving customers. You have inaccurate sales forecast? Just be sure to make more than enough inventory and don't worry about the forecast. You have unreliable suppliers? That's okay. Buy so much inventory to ensure that you're covered when suppliers ship late or have quality problems. You have your own problems with product quality? Just make enough good stuff along with the bad so that you can tap into the good stuff when you need it. In other words, inventory is often counted on to cover up problems elsewhere in a company's operations. Lean thinking, though, encourages you not to rely on inventory. Instead, you should address the problems. Figure out how to improve the forecast, or design flexible operations that can make you less dependent on the forecast and more responsive to actual demand when it happens. Only work with reliable suppliers or help existing suppliers to deliver better materials more reliably. Instead of accepting quality problems in your own operations, expect perfection and continuously improve your processes toward that goal. Deal with your problems and address them at the root cause, so that once they're solved, they don't reappear. That's the philosophy that took Toyota from the small automaker they were to the world's largest automaker of high-quality cars and trucks. Their success has motivated countless other companies to emulate them. It's estimated that more than 90% of all U.S. manufacturers make use of the lean principles that Toyota developed. With the advent of advanced technologies, production operations has embarked on a new and exciting journey. Developments in this area have been of an incremental nature over the past several decades, but one major development is threatening the entire system of factory-based mass production that we've known over the past century. The revolution that we're watching closely is the advent of 3D printing, or layered printing. Imagine a printer that rather than creating an image in two dimensions on a flat surface of paper, like a conventional document printer, instead prints in layers, in three dimensions, creating so-called form on the spot. 3D printing technology has found use in the production of models and prototypes in recent years, but the prospects for entering into form on the spot production have set our minds racing in the operations field. Just as we download music and books over the internet today, allowing us to consume these media without leaving the comfort of our homes, might it be possible to download 3D blueprints? Simply hit print and watch physical goods take shape right before our eyes. To date, 3D printing is limited to simple products with simple materials. That's changing quickly, though, as companies like General Electric are making huge investments in advancing the manufacturing capabilities of the printing equipment. Companies are also investing in material sciences so that advanced alloys can be developed for use in 3D printing's additive manufacturing processes. GE currently has more than 300 3D printers at work, and its aviation business expects to produce more than 100,000 different parts via 3D printing by 2020. Keep an eye on this technology as it progresses along the lines of so many other game-changing technologies, like the cell phone or the video cassette recorder before it. Capabilities of the technology will improve and prices will drop as the product gains popularity, justifying investment in R&D and expansion in production lines. Especially promising in the near term is the opportunity to customize products through form on the spot at retail locations. Another development to watch is the rise of nearshoring or reshoring. While some companies continue to favor outsourcing of their manufacturing operations to suppliers in low-cost countries, there's a trend in the opposite direction too. As it turns out, it's hard to anticipate all the things that can go wrong with offshoring until they occur. Frequent power outages, extraordinarily high labor turnover, traffic jams that last for days or even weeks, and cargo containers that simply never show up because they got washed overboard in transit. These things really happen, and the cost incurred to remedy these problems can be monumental. In the case of quality grievance that results in a product recall, it's conceivable that a company might never salvage a tarnished brand. Even in less severe circumstances, many companies today are realizing that the toll of producing in far-off locations may just be too high. In reaction to this reality, many companies that once offshored to low-cost countries are regionalizing their supply chains, meaning that they're seeking to produce closer to the markets they're trying to serve. Nearshoring refers to the practice of producing close to the focal market, probably in a location that still offers some cost advantage, but with less uncertainty than far-off locations. For many U.S. companies, this might mean serving the U.S. market from Mexico instead of China. Reshoring refers to bringing once offshore manufacturing back to home shores. This is a strategy that carries a lot of political momentum, but it can also make good business sense. GE, Motorola, Whirlpool, and Caterpillar are some of the U.S.-based companies that have adopted reshoring in recent years to much fanfare, and reportedly with favorable results. While much excitement surrounds developments like 3D printing, nearshoring, and reshoring, I believe that the next big wave of innovation in production operations will be in yet another important area of change, the focus on sustainability. Our ability to serve a growing population in a more sustainable fashion will be at the forefront of corporate decisions and national policy in the coming years. With rising wealth and a budding middle class in developing countries around the world, it will be imperative to find creative means to support teeming demand with our finite natural resources and without irreparably harming the environment. That could mean choosing different materials and creating products using manufacturing processes and energy sources that don't pollute the land, air, and water. I can envision the day when the world gathers with anticipation to see the latest custom-built fuel cell sports car. And my bet is that it's not far off. Production operations is a key factor in all of these developments. Whether it drives them or simply incorporates and adapts to them, it'll be central in the years ahead to some of the most dramatic changes in how we live, how we create, and how we interact with our planet.
This lecture is titled Refining Service Operations.
Over the past several decades, the United States has seen a major shift in its economy, from being manufacturing dominant to focusing more on services. This shift is reflected in the contribution to gross domestic product, where today's services sector represents nearly 70% of the nation's GDP. More pronounced, though, is the shift in employment. In 1960, the nation's largest employer was manufacturer General Motors. Today, it's Walmart, which employs over 1.4 million Americans. And services in total employ 6 out of 7 people in our workforce. Retail and food services alone represent 18% of the national employment. And the trend doesn't look to be slowing down. In this lecture, we'll examine the essentials of managing successful service operations, taking into account the complex psychology involved in winning over customers through great experiences. We'll see that there are significant differences between service operations and product-oriented operations, yet service operations still borrow some important concepts from the science of the production world. And in some situations, the two worlds merge in interesting ways. When we say services, we refer to a wide variety of activities, from consumer services like healthcare, restaurants, retail, and banking, to industrial and professional services like advertising, transportation, and legal services, to government and civil services, including schools, emergency services, and postal delivery. Perhaps the most fundamental difference between production operations and service operations is the intangibility of services as a deliverable. While service operations may sometimes have some of the attributes of physical products, the deliverable in services is an outcome or experience for the customer. In some ways, this can make the management of services more complicated and challenging than making a physical product, where the specs and requirements tend to be more concrete. One of the most significant developments in modern service operations was the establishment of the Service Quality Scale, or SERVQUAL for short. SERVQUAL is a measurement system dedicated to assessing customer satisfaction with services. Devised by Professors Parsu Parasuraman of the University of Miami, Valerie Zeithammel of the University of North Carolina, and Lynn Berry, Texas A&M University, in the late 1980s, SERVQUAL has revolutionized how we think about and assess service delivery. SERVQUAL's basic premise for discerning customer satisfaction is simple. It compares the customer's perception of the service rendering against the expectation the customer had going into the service arrangement. If the perceived service exceeds expectations, then the customer is satisfied. Should expectations not be met, the customer is said to be dissatisfied. The bigger the gap between expectations and perceived performance, the more extreme the emotion, either satisfaction or dissatisfaction. The SERVQUAL scale assesses service quality by comparing expectations and perceptions of performance across five important dimensions. The first is responsiveness, how promptly the service provider responds to the needs of the customer. The second dimension is assurance, the level of the customer's ease that the service will be conducted in accordance with his or her wishes. Next are the tangibles, the physical aspects of the service provision, including the facilities, equipment, and the personnel that will shape the customer's experience in the service arrangement. The next dimension is empathy, the sense of caring and understanding that a service provider extends to the customer. And the final dimension is reliability, the ability to perform the service on a dependable and accurate basis compared to what is promised. The SERVQUAL scale is sometimes referred by the acronym RATER for responsiveness, assurance, tangibles, empathy, and reliability. Allow me to share a recent example that will illustrate these five dimensions of service quality. My son Aiden and I share a common passion for athletic shoes. I'm an avid runner and he's a basketball and football player. But we have a penchant for the latest athletic shoes. For his most recent birthday, he insisted on a pair of Nike shoes that had just hit the market. Being the shoe nut too, I understood and began our hunt for the shoes. A web search quickly uncovered Zappos as a possible vendor. I'd never purchased from the company before, but had heard many great things about their customer service, so I decided to take a closer look. Of course, what I wanted to buy was a tangible product, shoes. But it was Zappos' service operations that made those shoes available, and it's their service performance that generates rave for the company. Instead of ordering the shoes online, I decided to call the company. Promptly on the second ring, a young man by the name of Daniel introduced himself and asked how he could help. I explained the situation and Daniel indicated he'd be happy to help make my son's birthday wish come true. He even explained that by calling into the customer service line, I would receive a complimentary upgrade to free second-day delivery. That really appealed to me because Aiden's birthday was just a few days away. I enjoyed a pleasant chat with Daniel, and he assured me that the shoes would arrive in plenty of time. Sure enough, the shoes arrived in pristine condition 2 days later, as promised. Later that same day, I received a handwritten card from Daniel, thanking me for my business and inviting me to visit the company's headquarters the next time I was in Las Vegas. Who sends written thank you cards today? Daniel did, and it floored me. Let's run through the RATER criteria quickly. Was the service responsive? Yes, the customer service representative answered the phone promptly and promised speedy delivery, which was realized. Assurance? Yes, I was assured that the right product would arrive in plenty of time for the birthday occasion. Oh, and the price was very competitive too, which provided me with a sense of assurance that I was getting a good deal. Daniel also indicated that if we weren't satisfied for any reason, we could return the shoes at no charge, which made me feel better about buying the product without the benefit of actually seeing it. Tangibles? The Zappos website was easy to use, the shoes themselves were the quality my son and I expected, and the card from Daniel was a nice touch. Empathy? Again, I was impressed with Daniel's sense of concern for my situation. Would the world end if the shoes arrived late? No, but I felt like Daniel was invested in helping to solve my problem. He was committed to see it through. And reliability, after all was said and done, the correct shoes arrived as promised, and I was billed the right amount. In sum, Zappos went 5 for 5 on the SERVQUAL dimensions. I came away from the shopping experience not merely satisfied, but delighted. Satisfied customers might come back and buy from the provider again, but delighted customers are more likely to tell others about their great experience, which can be priceless. So Daniel's actions set me up for a great experience, and then the operations personnel behind the scene at Zappos Fulfillment Center did their job and got the right shoes to us in a timely manner. What's not to like? This helps to explain why Zappos has become the juggernaut in shoes, handbags, and other fashion merchandise. In 2009, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com took an attitude of, if we can't beat them, join them, and acquired Zappos for $1.2 billion. Since the acquisition, Amazon and Zappos continued to march toward domination of internet retailing through a combination of immense product assortment and industry-leading service. Zappos' longtime CEO, Tony Hsieh, encourages customer service reps to not just take orders, but to have open and honest dialogue with customers, rather than rely on scripts, which has become the industry norm. Also, there's no limit on the duration of calls, which violates every rule of call center efficiency. It's reported that one call lasted more than 10 hours. That's clearly an outlier, but it underscores the emphasis on relationship building that so many other internet retailers simply discount. Arguably, relationships are of much greater importance in service industries than in production businesses, because service all comes down to trust, trusting that the outcome will be what you're seeking. In product systems, there's usually a disconnect between the people who do the work and the people who experience the product in use. And there's a lesson here for those working in production businesses. There's a very strong service component to what you do too, in providing a product, such as making sure that the product is available when and where a customer wants to acquire it, and being available should the customer have any questions about the product and its use, or concerns associated with the invoice for the order, as well as standing behind the product when it fails to live up to the customer's expectations. These are the intangible aspects of the product-service bundle that product-oriented companies need to have well in place. In addition to providing a scale of service quality, ServQual identifies several so-called service gaps that can turn customers off. An inability to match performance with expectations is but one of them. Another is found when the service provider and the customer have different expectations of the service that will be rendered. If there's a gap here, you can reasonably expect a gap in the post-service evaluation too. For this reason, it's important for the expectations to be ironed out at the outset of the engagement. Another gap of note is grounded in the term I mentioned earlier in the assessment of satisfaction and dissatisfaction, the perception of performance. Since services incorporate a host of intangibles in the rendering, they leave much open to interpretation, and perceptions are important. I once experienced a service situation where I was working for a company and an important customer complained about our deliveries consistently arriving late to a retail distribution center. We thought our truck deliveries were consistently on time. Eventually, we decided to go to the customer site and watch a truck actually arrive. When the truck passed through the gate of the receiving yard, we pointed at it saying, "There, see? The truck's here. Not only on time, but early." It was then that the customer's representative said that the truck doesn't actually arrive until it's backed up at a receiving dock at the facility. We were seeing the same metric, a very basic one, on-time delivery, in two different ways based on where the endpoint was in the process. It was a small but very important distinction that severely strained the relationship with our biggest customer. Clearly, we had to iron out the confusion. Handling customer expectations presents a slightly different challenge. I often ask my students if it's more important to manage expectations or perceptions of performance in delivering services to customers. We debate it for a while and inevitably conclude that it's critically important to manage both expectations and perceptions. The funny thing about expectations, though, is that they're always evolving. Even if you enter into a contract that's several inches thick, you can expect that customers' expectations will change over a contract's lifetime. And customers will usually come to expect higher levels of service or more services than the agreement specified. So you have to continually manage those expectations. Managing expectations can become especially important when you bail a customer out of a bad situation. Say a customer finds herself in a bind, and you move mountains and make the impossible happen. Rather than delivering service in the typical time, you shift your priorities and resources to help the customer out. Guess what? You've just proven that you can perform a miracle, and that miracle can very easily become the new norm if you're not careful. How do you handle that? Especially if you cannot provide the same level of service day in and day out. I recommend that you pick up the phone, call the customer, and say something like, "I'm pleased that we were able to help you out of this tough situation. We put everything else on hold to get this project done for you. Please realize that this was a special situation, and we'd like to work with you to figure out how to avoid this kind of crisis in the future." You get the idea. We're managing the expectation. Of course, if the whole experience teaches you that you can deliver at a heightened level, then you have a new service offering, and you can charge accordingly for it. Because effective service is so important to meeting customer demands, a whole field of study has developed on how to refine service operations. It comes from production operations, and it's called process improvement. All work, whether it's manufacturing widgets or making espressos, is completed in processes. Each process involves a series of steps where inputs are converted into outputs for a customer. And the two most influential methods for process improvement are already familiar to you from the production operations context: Lean and Six Sigma. Let's take a look now at how they can be applied to achieving excellent service operations. The premise of both Lean and Six Sigma is that no process is perfect, and that all processes can stand to improve. This reasoning is particularly true in services because they rely on people, even more so than manufacturing operations, which have become increasingly automated over time. To err is human, goes the old adage. And that's a simple fact in services. We rely on people to do much of the work, and people are prone to errors. The lessons for managing human resources in service environments are too complex and too many in number to address in this one lecture. But let's turn to what we know about processes that can help to achieve reliable, high-performing services. One principle of process improvement is the concept of standard work. This means finding the best way to complete a work task, documenting it, and teaching it to others. This is a pretty simple idea, but it's hard to achieve in service environments where operators tend to develop individual patterns of behavior. When no standards exist for the work, you can expect different qualities in the outcome. Different procedures by different workers result in different experiences for customers, some good, some bad. So how do we provide a consistently good experience for customers? That was the problem that Starbucks set out to address in 2009 when the company set up its Lean Innovation Lab. The goal was to develop and test different ways to perform store routines in search of the best way to perform all varieties of work in the coffee shops, including cleanup, restocking the displays, and preparing the coffee. As it turned out, the benefits of the initiative were many. By finding and standardizing its best practices, Starbucks ensured a cleaner and more appealing sitting area and reduced the amount of time and waste and motion involved in brewing and serving the coffee. Creating standard work routines resulted in positive customer experiences more consistently, and this fueled top-line growth and reduced cost. Wendy's has implemented standard work to achieve the fastest drive-through experience in the quick-service restaurant industry. They prefer that we not call it fast food. Whereas competing restaurants talk about adding extra drive-through lanes to deal with demand surges, Wendy's has reduced the lead time, the amount of time it takes to fill the order, which enables the store to handle more volume in a given period. As of this taping, Wendy's takes on average 134 seconds to fill an order compared to McDonald's 189 seconds, and Burger King's 198 seconds. That may not sound like much, but by saving about a minute with each order over the course of a day, Wendy's is able to serve many more customers, and to do so with fewer staff. This points us to another valuable way to apply lean principles in service settings, by comparing process time with something called tact time, spelled T-A-K-T. Tact is a German term that refers to the targeted or goal time for an activity, the amount of time in which you must complete an activity in order to keep pace with demand. In contrast, process time refers to the amount of time required to actually complete the activity. Let's look at an example to show how these two measures relate to one another. We'll focus on a service that I use from time to time, a men's grooming salon. The owner of the salon would like to achieve as much throughput as possible in his shop. Many of the costs associated with the shop are fixed, meaning that they don't change with the number of customers that pass through the shop. So the more customers, the more revenue, and the more profit. Let's say that on average it takes 20 minutes for a simple haircut. This is the process time for the work. Over the course of an 8-hour day, a stylist could tend to 3 customers an hour, or 24 customers for the day. What if the shop has demand for 80 haircuts in a day? Can we take care of all 80 customers in the 1 8-hour shift? Clearly not with only one stylist, because we have 80 times 20 minutes, or 1,600 minutes of work to do. That's 26 and two-thirds hours of work, and that's a long work day. No, we'll need to turn customers around much quicker. In 8 hours, we have 480 minutes. Divide the 480 by 80, and we determine attack time, the pace of demand, to be one customer every 6 minutes. But our process time is more than 3 times that, at 20 minutes. What this means is that we'll need 20 divided by 6, or 3 1/3 times more resource to get the job done in the allotted 8 hours. That means 3 people full-time and a 4th person for another 2 to 3 hours to get all 80 customers in and out the door in 8 hours. We will also need more chairs, sinks, and grooming supplies in the same proportion to allow each stylist to keep pace. So this comparison of process time and tact time can be helpful in determining the amount of resources that we need to employ to get the job done in an allotted amount of time. But the real lesson here is not simply to take these numbers as given. Think back to the Starbucks and Wendy's examples of a few minutes ago. By finding the best way to perform the work, both companies reduced the process time required to serve their customers, making them better able to meet greater demand. Are there work steps in our grooming salon that could be removed or done faster? Or are there mistakes that could be eliminated, requiring less rework? Perhaps one employee could do the job of sweeping the salon floor so the stylist could focus exclusively on cutting hair and getting more haircuts done per hour. By thinking through the work and devising best practice standard work, we can reduce the amount of time it takes to do the job. Also, ensuring that we do the job right the first time ensures that we don't have to spend time going back and fixing problems. Another variable that companies sometimes overlook when managing the supply-demand equation is their ability to alter demand through pricing. That's not a service operations decision per se, but it has a big impact on the provision of services. Consider Dell's direct-to-consumer model of selling computers online. They've long employed a sell-what-you-have strategy that helps to drive customers to the products they have in high inventory and away from items that are at risk of going into back order. How? By changing the menu price for these items in a dynamic manner. When they run short on something, the price goes up. When an item's in an oversupply or at risk of becoming obsolete, it gets featured or marked down in price. In this way, they influence demand on items. Not just how much demand and how many customers, but when demand happens. Related to the pace of demand, something that anyone working in services knows is that if you have to staff a business at all times to handle unexpected peaks in demand, you'll have immense amounts of slack. To address this problem, Lean also provides us with the concept of heijunka, a Japanese term that means smoothing out of demand. Remember that it was Japanese car maker Toyota that gave us the concept of Lean in the first place. In a manufacturing environment, it's not uncommon to have one shift that works feverishly and another that doesn't. Manufacturers also run out of capacity on some days and have idle capacity on others. Something similar happens in service operations, and the problem can be especially challenging at the retail level. Consider a bricks and mortar store where customers walk in off the street at unpredictable times. The thing about a physical shop is that it doesn't expand or contract with the volume of business. It's a fixed size. You're paying rent on the full space regardless of the number of customers. If you own the space, then you're paying taxes on the footprint of the property regardless of how it gets used day in and day out. And paying staff to sit idle can get very expensive. So there are plenty of reasons why it would be beneficial if you could smooth out customer demand. Let's say customers have a habit of showing up in a big rush on Fridays just before the weekend. Is there a way that you can possibly influence them to come in on a Wednesday or Thursday instead? There is, and that's why you might see other stores offering aggressive pricing, discounts, or other promotions to drive business to those off-peak days. Doing the same would allow you to serve more customers over the course of the week and reduce the frustration and disappointment faced by customers who are left waiting or turned away during the peak times. And in spite of the price reductions, you might realize higher profits too. Some companies are turning to social media like Facebook and Twitter to bolster demand during off-peak times, offering flash discounts or special deals to their followers. The risk of this strategy is that you might get people addicted to the lower prices, and they might refuse to pay full price in the future. But some companies seem willing to take that risk. Six Sigma 2 can be applied in service environments. The term you